Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is a great event. You're actually seeing two inaugurals in one. Jonathan is giving his, and I'm giving my inaugural introduction. Jonathan Rosenhead was educated in Cambridge, where he took a degree in mathematics. He then came to London to do his master's degree at University College London, and then went promptly into industry. He went from industry to America, and then in 1967, he came to LSE, where he has been ever since, being made professor of OR in 1987. Title of his inaugural lecture, Into the Swamp, the Analysis of Social Issues, is not only intriguing, but I think it accurately describes at least a social phenomenon that I and my colleagues have personally experienced today. I think we have had a slightly swampy excursion into the higher reaches of higher education finance, top-up fees, and the rest. And I can assure you, Jonathan, that no one is looking forward to hearing how we should have conducted ourselves in that unpleasant part of the country than I and those colleagues of mine whom I recognise in the audience to have spent the best part of the afternoon with me in the coordinating committee. We look forward eagerly to hearing what we actually should have done. Thank you.
A title like the one I have devised, Into the Swamp, the Analysis of Social Issues, requires, I think, some explanation. Indeed, I feel I should give some explanation as to why I'm giving it an inaugural at all. After all, I have, as the director has pointed out, been here 23 years, and that scarcely counts as a new boy, especially in present company. I've even been a professor for 3 years, and though I have been frightfully busy as the government racks up the pressure on academics, I dare say I could have found time to squeeze in just, say, one inaugural in that time. But the explanation as to why it has been delayed is that I was appointed to my chair in July 1987 and took up my post in October of that year, all of which was in the immediate aftermath of Mrs. Thatcher's third overwhelming election victory. When invited shortly thereafter by Dr. Patel to give an inaugural lecture, I realised that the sort of things I wanted to say would seem implausible, quite lacking in credibility, as the enterprise culture swept triumphantly onwards. So I decided on delay. I replied that I would give one in Michaelmas term 1990. My rationale, which I may say I kept private, was that if the onward march of the enterprise culture were by any chance to falter, then things would by about now be nicely warming up towards a general election. And it might seem more realistic to discuss some alternative routes into the socio-political future. Proved not to be a bad guess. In fact, it was rather a good guess. Indeed, almost the only thing I'd like to thank the Conservative government for is for making my inaugural more relevant. None of this, I should say, will appear in the printed text. I'm not Mrs. Thatcher, so do not need to read agreed official communiques, and in any case, the temptation to deviate would probably prove to be too great for me as it did for her. I would like to reassure, however, those with a concern for the proprieties that the printed text will follow the same track as the delivered version, but in a more measured prose. It may seem strange for the political timetable to affect the timing of an operational research lecture. Practitioners in my subject often see it as apolitical, positively technocratic. But the subject matter of this lecture is, in fact, the overlap between the domain of politics and the sort of analysis which operational research might offer. So, we get to the title of the lecture. Into the Swamp, the Analysis of Social Issues. Everyone who has spoken to me has been puzzled by this title. Some of them by the main title, Into the Swamp, and some by the subtitle, The Analysis of Social Issues. On the latter aspect, one of my colleagues, who I see is present today, said, I assume that you are going to talk about the philosophy of the social sciences. I was rather daunted, and indeed the answer is no. My concern is rather with the action orientation of social analysis rather than with the self-reflection of the social sciences. Another colleague took me by the elbow in the corridor and said to me, almost hissed, "I admire your nerve," and then darted into his room, and I never found out why. However, most people have been puzzled by the swamp, recognized as evidently metaphorical, but the question is, what was the metaphor? One operational research practitioner, who I'm glad to see here, actually telephoned me up to ask if it was the same metaphorical swamp which featured in the folklore of IBM staff about 20 years or so ago. And indeed, he even reconstructed the quote more or less from memory. He assures me that the end of it is actually correct. The initial words might possibly be slightly in error, but they do actually cover the general sense. This was an alleged sort of project report. The objective is to analyze all the issues thoroughly, identify all possible alternative solutions, etc., 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 before acting swiftly in the sure knowledge that you're taking the right way forward. However, when you are up to your asterisk, 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 in alligators, it's difficult to remember that your original objective was to drain the swamp. I should explain those asterisks. These are in deference to my mother, who has never heard the word that I have replaced, and also to my daughter Rosa, who is fined 5p every time she uses it. Anyhow, the answer, Alan, is no, it is not the same swamp, but it is a very similar swamp. This is Donald Schoen's swamp, so I will find that. This is a quotation from his book on educating the reflective practitioner. I will read it, since it's rather difficult up there. In the swampy lowland, messy, confusing problems defy technical solution. The irony of this situation is that the problems of the high ground tend to be relatively unimportant to individuals or society at large, however great their technical interest may be, while in the swamp lie the problems of greatest human concern. The practitioner must choose. Shall he remain on the high ground, where he can solve relatively unimportant problems according to prevailing standards of rigor? Or shall he descend to the swamp of important problems and non-rigorous inquiry? Now, this quotation encapsulates the most significant debate that has been going on now for quite some time in contemporary operational research. What I plan to talk about is some of the results of this debate. The restriction, by and large, of operational research to problems of the high ground, the consequent impoverishment of the analysis of social issues, and then go on to give some evidence and argument that operational research has a contribution to make in the swamp as well as on the high ground, and some thoughts on institutions to improve the quality of political debate. So I would have called the lecture The Contribution of Operational Research to Policy Analysis if I didn't mind having a rather smaller audience. So the two themes are operational research and policy analysis. We should start with operational research and make our way by stages towards policy analysis. I am the first holder of the established chair in operational research at LSE, but operational research has a far longer history here. The title of Professor of Operational Research was first held by Elsa Land. Indeed, we have done graduate teaching in operational research here at LSE for more than 30 years. Indeed, the historical connection between operational search and LSE predates that. One of the World War II pioneers of operational search, Cecil Gordon, about whom I've written at length, was earlier a PhD student here at the school with Lancelot Hogben in the Department of Social Biology in the early 1930s. Operational search itself, as an activity with an explicit identity, dates only from about 1937, plus or minus a year. It originated in the run-up to World War II, and specifically in the development of radar. In that connection, there was one strand of scientific and technical work which was concerned to improve the range and the accuracy of radar equipment, but a second strand was spun off to improve the use made of radar information in a complex wartime organization. The first strand was known as weapons research. The second strand, to distinguish it, was called operational research, and that is where we get our name from. The work on radar was a great success, and indeed it spread throughout the armed services during the war and from here across the Atlantic to the United States and around the world. Cecil Gordon, whom I mentioned earlier, his work was for Coastal Command, whose concern was getting, well, his particular concern was getting more flying hours out of Coastal Command aircraft fighting the Battle of the Atlantic against German U-boats. By studying the flying and maintenance cycle, his work was called Plan Flying, Plan Maintenance, by studying the flying maintenance cycle of Coastal Command aircraft, he was able to achieve a doubling of the sorties which could be flown with the same number of aircraft. Gordon was not perhaps quite in the first rank of wartime operational researchers, but he did share one characteristic with many who were in the first rank and many who were a good deal less senior. He was a committed socialist, as, for example, were PMS Blackett and Desmond Bernal, two of the towering figures of those early days of operational research. Many others who are well-known names, Watson Watt, C.H. Waddington, were touched to a greater or lesser extent by the same socialist ideas. That socialist scientists were prominent in operational research is no accident. Following Bernal, who was the dominant intellectual influence, they believed that capitalism could not make full use of science's benevolent potential. They pressed in the 1930s for science to be used in the public rather than in sectional interests. They banged on the door in vain until war gave them their chance to do something scientific in the public interest rather than in sectional interest. Gordon, in particular, after the war, tried to pursue this line of thought, not in argument, but in action, in the period of post-war reconstruction, where most of the scientists went back to work in their laboratories in their own subjects. Gordon stayed on. He was appointed to the key government operational research post, head of the Special Research Unit at the Board of Trade. He attempted there to devise and implement radical, quantitatively based methods for improving the efficiency of British industry. And he lasted for about 2 years. He was squeezed out and the unit was closed down behind him. I've considered all these questions in greater detail in a paper which came out last year. It is worth noting that Tessa Blackstone and William Plowden, in their book on the Central Policy Review staff, refer to the Board of Trade's successor body, the Department of Trade and Industry, as, I quote, short on what might be called analytic propensity. This was in the context of Central Policy Review staff, which I will call CPRS for short. This was in the context of CPRS work on industrial policy circa 1976. But lack of analytic propensity was also a factor in 1946. But by 1948, there were added factors. There was the Attlee administration shift against governmental intervention and central planning, and there was the start of the Cold War. On both grounds, operational research was unacceptable. It was evicted from government and found acceptance, perhaps surprisingly, instead in industry, where methods for strengthening central control were not ideologically forbidden and indeed were quite welcome. OR went on to develop elaborate analytic tools for handling decision-making under uncertainty and in particular under conditions of complexity. The tools which they developed, however, were developed in and for the conditions of industry and of business more generally. In the United States, military operational research remains significant. But the even more complex, turbulent, and interactive world in which public policy in peacetime is formulated did not significantly shape the subsequent growth of operational research or its methods. This takes us back to Donald Schoen's swamp. Operational research developed in the 1950s and 60s methods to find technical solutions to well-defined problems. These were basically efficiency problems within large unitary organizations. The methods found the best way of pursuing an objective already agreed with implementation to be achieved through the organization's own chain of command. These are problems of the high ground. The problems of the swamp are quite different. How to agree what subset of all the interacting factors constitutes, at least for the time being, the problem. How to negotiate a way forward in situations beset with uncertainties. How to find a policy which takes account of both technical feasibility and the existence of diverse interest groups. I wonder if that is a characterization of the problems that the coordinating committee was wrestling with this afternoon. For these sorts of problems, common in the public policy domain, and also, I would say, at strategic levels in unitary organizations, operational research's optimizing methods offer no appropriate handle. There was a brief period in the late 60s and early 70s when it was thought that you might be able simply to expand the scope of operational research's optimizing techniques, to throw in more variables, to solve the whole social problem. This approach has been labeled the moon ghetto metaphor. There are many people who made statements of this sort. I will just select one, which is the briefest. This is Hubert Humphrey in 1968, when I think he probably was still Vice President of the United States. The techniques that are going to put a man on the moon are going to be exactly the techniques that we are going to need to clean up our cities. That is the moon ghetto metaphor. The moon is a metaphor for the tremendously complicated technical problems which we have already learned to solve, so nothing could be as complicated as that, and solving the problems of the ghetto will be relatively straightforward. The mostly American proponents of this approach called their approach policy analysis, and their hopelessly overambitious claims gave those words a bad name, which is why, incidentally, they don't feature in the title of my lecture. The outcome of this collapse of policy analysis under the weight of its own pretensions has been bad for operational research, but I believe it has been worse for society. Important social issues have been deprived of appropriate analytic structuring, or left to the formulations of economists, a case of the devil and the deep blue sea. I'd rather not specify which is which. In either case, the inadequacy of public policy analysis contributes to an impoverishment of political debate. Cases for particular policies based on their possible consequences have been neither clearly advanced nor effectively rebutted. The language and tradition are simply not there. Of course, the shambles of British public policy making over, shall we say, the last dozen years or so is not all the fault of operational research. There are larger forces at work. One straw in the wind, I would suggest, is the demise of the Central Policy Review staff itself. Set up by Edward Heath in 1971, it was a pioneering attempt to provide enhanced analytic capability at the centre of government. It was abolished by Margaret Thatcher in 1983. I don't propose to extol the virtues of the CPRS, nor to list its shortcomings. The ground has been well ploughed. There are expert authors I know present in the audience, and indeed the director himself was a member of the CPRS between 1976 and 1981, has written very illuminatingly on the experience. However, I can't at this point resist a historical detour, taking us back to Cecil Gordon in 1948. In that year, he was the author of a report advocating something quite like the CPRS. The report was called The Principles and Practices of Operational Research, and he was the principal author, and it was adopted by the Panel on Technology and Operational Research of a body called the Committee on Industrial Productivity. Now, it was a short-lived body, but it's interesting to note that the Panel on Technology and Operational Research was actually regarded as a panel on operational research and technology. In other words, at that stage, operational research was regarded as a very major component in how one might improve the effectiveness of organizations in a fairly wide-ranging sense. The purpose of the Principles and Practices report was to encourage wide dissemination of operational research throughout industry and government. It was killed off by an unholy alliance of ministries opposed to its interventionist stance, and the report itself was never formally published. You have to go to the Public Record Office to find it. It's just one of the recommendations of this report which concerns us here, which I will put up. This was that an operational research unit should be established as part of the central machinery of government to undertake the study of broad and national problems and to be available to the central economic planners and others. A distant echo of what CPRS turned out to be, but it didn't happen in 1948. And when, a generation later, CPRS was set up, it wasn't an operational research unit. It did, for a few years, include one member who was recruited from a government operational research group, and he thought he was the only operational researcher in it, and when he was there, he found to his surprise three other people there with operational research backgrounds, but who had moved to other roles before they entered the CPRS itself. However, regardless of the makeup of the group, the CPRS itself carried out no noticeably OR-influenced studies. However, returning all the way from 1948 past the CPRS to its demise, its abolition in 1983 is, I believe, indicative of a negative attitude by the government of the day, which is also the government of our day, to policy analysis based on evidence and argument, not just on principles and gut reaction. What analysis is now done in the environs of Downing Street is done in the Prime Minister's policy unit. An illuminating account of how this works has been given by a former member, David Willetts. Unlike the CPRS, the Prime Minister's policy unit does not undertake long-term, large-scale studies, but offers policy advice on matters of current concern, with a deadline from an hour to a few days ahead. More important, the advice does not go to Cabinet, where it could be rebutted by departmental ministries and debated. It is for her eyes and ears only. One consequence, and I quote David Willetts, is that the policy unit, because it is directly subordinated to the most senior and astute politician of the lot, is not afraid of putting forward what might initially appear to be politically far-fetched. As an unfriendly observer put it to me, this is a channel for the delivery of untreated sewage. Now, why should any Prime Minister want this stuff in her backyard? Plausibly, it is a version of the bounce. This is a civil service stratagem described by Blackstone and Plowden in their book about the CPRS. It's a stratagem by which a department tables a key proposal at the last minute in such a way that it requires instant and unreflective action so that nobody can muster an effective case against it. In an analogous way, the policy unit of the Prime Minister supplies her with a radically new policy consistent with her principles. She announces the policy publicly, thereby establishing a political fait accompli. The relevant department then has the job of trying to make it work, which, as it has not been subjected to critical scrutiny, may be a touch difficult. The stratagem clearly needs a new name to distinguish it from the bounce, and I would propose the boomerang. Much of this is in detail particular to what Mrs. Thatcher calls my style. And so it is in danger of becoming of historical interest only by Tuesday next. However, the New Right Revolution is far broader than Thatcher, and its influence will outlast her. For needless to say, not all the policy ingredients are concocted actually on the premises of Number 10. Right-wing think tanks in particular have had a very significant impact, partly through a drip effect, through their insistent promotion of market-based policies. They have secured palpable shifts in the accepted wisdom. Some of the influence is more direct. They have been the first or last advocate of policies subsequently adopted by the government. Typical of their method of analysis is to start with strong value assertions and then proceed with a minimum of intervening argument to detailed prescriptions. Argumentation is basically intuitive with a public choice analysis school flavour. I don't have time to go into public choice, but I'm sure there are people here who know of the public choice school. Proposals are not costed or quantified. There is an appeal at most to anecdotal evidence, but certainly there is no research. The list of policies traceable to such influences is formidable. That's just the short list. There are many more. Many of these policies have produced administrative or political chaos, sometimes both, which is not really surprising in view of the poverty of preceding analysis implicit both in the think tank's methodology, the right-wing think tank's methodologies, and the government's approach to the policy process. It's worth substantiating that claim with a few examples. Indeed, I'm indebted here to a range of colleagues both inside and outside the school who will be acknowledged in the written text rather than here. I've got four examples, which I'll go through at a fair rate of knots. The first is the Education Reform Act of 1988. These proposals were circulated on a limited basis in duplicated form in August 1987. Comments were required to be in by October. The bill was published that same autumn and went on into law at top speed, a timescale which indicates no intention to listen to responses in order to recast proposals. In fact, I would suggest the contrary. This practice would be misguided even in a thoroughly researched scheme, doubly so in this case, where it was quite evident from the results that the attitude of parents to local authority control of schools, for example, had simply not been determined. Simply or wrongly, it had been assumed that parents would be falling over themselves to have their schools opt out, whereas in fact quite the contrary has proved to be the case. One might suspect that the breakneck rush to legislation through semi-private pseudo-consultation was motivated by an awareness that the proposals would not survive debate informed by analytic scrutiny. Example number two, the student loan scheme of roughly the same vintage. As is well known, colleagues here at LSE made major contributions to debate on this issue. Their alternative proposals and their criticisms of the government's own scheme led to meetings with ministers, their economic advisers, senior civil servants from both the Department of Education and Science and the Treasury. At these meetings, it was the LSE group who were better informed and better prepared, and not just theoretically, when it came to the practical implications, the size of debt, the payoff period, the administrative costs of securing repayment, the likely default rate, the unattractiveness of the arrangements to banks. On all of these matters, the LSE group were raising real difficulties in the government scheme, which had simply not been worked through by the government participants. It was the LSE, not the government, which had done its homework. The government pressed ahead, nevertheless, with its scheme, and within a year the banks withdrew, as indeed the LSE participants had expected, forcing the government to establish its own student loan company at still greater administrative expense. There is still a very real chance of the administrative collapse of the whole scheme when repayments start around 1992. A third example. Let us move to the National Health Service. Under pressure of public opinion on bed closures and underfunding in 1988, for example, the presidents of the Royal Colleges made an unprecedented joint warning to the government about what they were doing to the health service. Mrs. Thatcher threw a boomerang. She announced the National Health that there would be a National Health Service review in a television interview with Jonathan Dimbleby, an initiative of which the entire NHS and Department of Health, even their top echelons, had no advance notice. The government timetable allowed just 1 year for the complete redesign of an organisation which is the third largest in the world, or the tenth largest in the world. I mean, it depends how you count, but it's sufficient, quite sufficiently large. It depends whether you count capital or manpower, for example. The review was conducted not as a royal commission with evidence subject to scrutiny, but in private. The result was a game of musical propositions in which the outcome depended on the state of play when the music stopped. For example, just 2 weeks before the publication of the results of the review, they still hadn't decided whether to limit the proposals to hospital and primary care or to include community care. Just 2 days before the review report was to be published, an independent management expert was telephoned from the Number 10 policy unit for advice on whether the NHS should have a separate management board and policy board or whether they could be both merged into one body. I can only say, what a way to run a government. And the fourth example, poll tax. The poll tax, probably crucial in the current disarray of the government and certainly its biggest liability, dates back to 1985 when Mrs. Thatcher threw a boomerang in a public meeting in Scotland. Domestic rates, she said, were to be abolished in Scotland. When the message got home to Whitehall, there was need for impromptu clarification, in which it eventually emerged that domestic rates would be abolished in the whole of the country and not just in Scotland. The trouble was that there was no obvious alternative. They'd all been reviewed exhaustively many times, and a repeated conclusion had been arrived at that there was no acceptable solution to the domestic rates. There were a series of hurried internal government studies which eventually led to the selection of the poll tax. By a simple procedure, they eliminated all the others, several on politico-ideological grounds. For example, local income tax, which might appear to have its attractions, was not allowed because it ran counter to the government's drive to reward high earners. As far as can be determined, there were no studies of the economic consequences of the poll tax. What would be its redistributive impact? What would be its impact on inflation and pay bargaining? Not even, it seems, was there an adequate analysis of its impact on the government's most precious commodity, its electoral support? The burden proved to fall most heavily on the C2 group of electors on whom the Thatcher coalition crucially depends. This was eminently researchable. Indeed, it was researched after the event by LSE academics, but it was not researched by the government in advance of the decision. The purpose of producing these examples is not to say that it is operational research-based analysis, which was missing in every case, though in several instances I would suggest it could have been helpful. Nor is it to say that all government policies have been as badly prepared as those I have described. Nor is it to say that I'm any more in favour of those which had the benefit of analysis than I am of those which did not. In any case, I would not like any of you to go away with the impression that I dislike the policies whose formulation process I have been sketching in. I do not dislike them. I positively deplore them. But that is not the point of my exposition. My purpose here is to draw attention to the catastrophic retreat from reason in public affairs executed under the current administration. This is especially serious in a radically interventionist government. There is some excellent advice available from a source which the current government, including its head, might well respect, and I will display that now. It reads as follows. An ignorant man who is not fool enough to meddle with his clock is, however, sufficiently confident to think he can safely take to pieces and put together, at his pleasure, a moral machine of another guise, importance, and complexity, composed of far other wheels and springs and balances and counteracting and cooperating powers. Men little think how immorally they act in rashly meddling with what they do not understand. Now, that quotation, which I dare say some people here will recognize, is from Edmund Burke in 1791. As we are all feminists nowadays, I suppose we should transform the sexes, and, for example, the last sentence would read, "Women little think how immorally they act in rashly meddling with what they do not understand." Now, this statement of Burke's can be read as a call to inaction, that one simply shouldn't meddle. But this is quite impossible in turbulent times such as our own, and therefore I think it reads better as a convincing call to better analysis before action. Morality, then, as well as common sense, suggests that governments should do their best to anticipate the consequences of significant reforms, and best here includes quantitative analysis of the interaction between relevant factors where appropriate. If this is true of a radical right-wing government, then I believe it should be even more so of a radical government of the left, if we can for a moment allow our imaginations to run riot. There are a number of reasons, I think, why this applies. One, that a government of the left can expect a less supine or compliant media, and one hopes would not wish to adopt the bully girl tactics of this administration to the press and TV. Therefore, it would be more unmercifully exposed in any policy bungling through inadequate analysis. It follows, I think, that a radical left government would stand to gain from an active, informed debate about policies ahead of commitment, a debate which might well be fostered by the sort of institutional proposals or something like them, which I will come to shortly. And fourthly, I believe, or lastly, because a radical government of the left would, I believe, be more committed to reason and less committed to the market. Which leads us on to some of the intellectual underpinnings of the government's analytic record. Poverty of analysis is not, of course, down to one person or his or her personality. The currently dominant ideology incorporates an almost mystical belief in market forces. The assertions are, first, that through market forces, individual preferences can find untrammeled expression. Second, that the market handles supply-demand equilibration better than bureaucracies can, and third, that free competition provides an automatic mechanism for efficiency improvements. These assumptions underlie both the government's program and the public choice school of political analysis practiced by the right-wing think tanks. The market is presented as correcting government failures rather than, as I was brought up to believe, the other way round. Even in cases, as in so many instances of privatization, cases where the market is imperfect and indeed imperfectible, where the market is artificial, where the market is rigged. The market is seen uncritically as a pseudo-natural phenomenon which substitutes for the exercise of collectively rational choice. So the downgrading of rational choice based on analysis is not an accidental phenomenon. It stems from the elevation of the market to almost divine, omnipotent, omniscient status. The dominant position which this ideology holds is relatively new, and indeed might well prove to be short-lived. However, it has been supported by a longer-term current of intellectual thought involving names such as Popper, Hayek, and Lindblom. These are intellectuals who stress the weakness of predictive theory, the limitations on cognitive capacity. They express deep pessimism about the rational solubility of problems. Out of this has grown a critique of what has been called hyper-rationalism, which has been defined as an irrational belief in the omnipotence of reason. Undoubtedly, this was a problem some 20 years or so ago in the policy analysis school, which I referred to earlier, but it is not the problem nowadays. Currently, a much more major problem is what I would call hyper-irrationalism, which I define as a willful failure to concede a significant role to reason in the improvement of collective decision-making. Such an attitude in an advanced society with large-scale enterprises and dense interconnections of policy issues is a recipe for disaster, a recipe for both market failure and government failure. What I think we need to do is to rescue the word rationality from those who earlier gave it a narrow, quantitative, and predictive interpretation as the elimination of the need for judgment. We need to extend the concept of rationality to include systematic approaches to the partial structuring of complexity and uncertainty, to enable judgment to be enriched and informed, and so to be employed with due confidence. That is, we don't attempt to replace judgment, we attempt to appropriately to support it in dealing with complexity and uncertainty. Methods for doing just this have recently been emerging in some number from the operational research community, and particularly in this country. Paradoxically, they have been coming out most strongly in the past 12 years of societal retreat from reason. These methods, which have been called problem structuring methods, as opposed to problem solving methods, problem structuring methods provide ways not of finding optimal solutions to well-formulated problems, but rather of helping a group with disparate perspectives to agree, nevertheless, on a common problem focus and an initial commitment to action. These methods, like conventional operational research, provide help by structuring complexity. But unlike conventional operational research techniques, the approaches are transparent and participative. They are enabling rather than controlling. There's no time to expand on these methods further. You can read all about it in a book which I edited last year, ambitiously titled Rational Analysis for a Problematic World. It's worth, just in closing this little passage about methods, to cite our director on the do's and don'ts for politicians apropos policy analysis, because in his pamphlet on the subject, he came out with one of his lessons was, do not despise formal methods. Problem structuring methods in particular should not be despised. They provide forms of guidance appropriate to the testing conditions of swamp navigation. The methods have so far been little used in public policy analysis. They have been used much more at the strategic levels in corporations and also in operational research work for community groups. The scope for their application in government is almost unlimited, and indeed there are considerable scope for the more traditional methods also. Where is the scope? Where complexities and interconnectedness abound, where uncertainties are high, where issues cross departmental boundaries, where diverse interests need to be taken into account, that should be enough to be going on with. It includes the areas of analysis deprivation, which I've already discussed. There are further examples. For example, in devising policy relating to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, or in considering the interaction between health policy and transport policy. It's worth noting, as I discovered in the last week or so, that both a major airline and a major oil company have used their operational research groups to construct alternative scenarios of the Kuwait crisis. It would be reassuring if we could believe that this government was doing likewise rather than just considering military scenarios. But in any case, why should the devil have all the best tunes, as I think Bernard Shaw once said, or in this case, why should the government have all the best analysis? The abolition of CPRS led to the centralization of policy analysis on the Prime Minister rather than the Cabinet. The result was negative. Multiple advocacy was avoided, and with it the debate and criticism from which viable policy can emerge. Now, it's not a case of one rule for the Cabinet and another for the rest of society. Multiple advocacy can be still further enhanced if analytic capability is more widely disseminated, not just from the Prime Minister to the Cabinet, but from the Cabinet outwards to other people. One such proposal is contained in a paper prepared last month for the Institute for Public Policy Research, though not yet published. It recommends establishing policy research and information units for all parliamentary select committees to make these committees' scrutiny of government policy more effective. And access to these units would also be available to independent into individual MPs. That would be, I think, just a modest starting point. Certainly we could go further. Political parties will be better able to devise strategies and policies if they are the means of sifting through the multiple alternatives open to them in a coherent way. To take just one example, the Labour Party has set up a working group to explore alternative electoral systems. To the best of my knowledge, no one with operational research-related experience is going to sit on it, nor is there currently an intention of gaining access to operational research expertise. Yet the problem cries out for an operational research input. There are a score, or maybe two, of possible electoral arrangements that are already in existence in various countries. There are perhaps 10 desirable criteria for judging between the different electoral arrangements, and a wide variety of possible voting patterns to consider. I believe that probably any operational research practitioner in the audience could suggest perhaps more than one possibly useful approach to tackling that problem. But I would like to continue this process of expansion. There is no need to regard analytic advice as a privilege for those active in formal politics. An advanced society such as ours is thickly populated with groups which are pursuing, or more likely defending, the particular interests which unite their members, whether at the national or at the local level. Though I think organisations like trade unions, tenants' associations, parent-teachers' associations, environmental pressure groups, and so on and so on. Many of these could never afford full-time analytic support, but the quality of political debate in the country will be greatly improved when the participants and potential participants in such debates can prepare and present their cases more adequately. Analytic assistance, including that of an operational research nature, can enable them to take into account more of the complexities of their situation. They can take into account the position of other groups, the unresolvable uncertainties which require flexibility, etc., etc. Active citizenry will become a reality when we have institutions to support broad, informed social debate. The question I would now like to move to is how could this best be provided? There are a fair number of models. For example, there are the Dutch science shops offering scientific and technological information to the general public on the high street. In Sweden, there is Arbetslivscentrum, an independent institute for practical interdisciplinary research on work-life issues, funded by a wage tax paid by all employers. In Britain, the Royal Town Planning Institute set up Planning Aid to assist members of the public or groups. And the Operational Research Society has established a community operational research unit located at Northern College, outside Barnsley, to carry out operational research studies for community groups. In parallel, a network of volunteers, of currently some 200 strong, has sprung up to do such work, such operational research work, voluntarily in their spare time. Details of how to provide disseminated analytic support would repay further study. Probably, we should adopt a multiplicity of forms and channels. Almost certainly, we will need a substantial and continuing growth in the number of independent think tanks and research institutes, etc., with a pragmatic orientation towards applied policy analysis. Probably, we will require a matching program of funding both for analytic provider agencies and for classes of user organization. The necessary research units do not exist in sufficient numbers and will need to be brought into existence, and that will cost some money. Some money should be supplied directly to the suppliers of services rather than just to those who might use the services, because these units should also have some scope for pursuing self-generated topics. Particular think tanks would no doubt specialise in particular application areas, but the characteristic orientation should be towards interdisciplinary studies, within which operational search would undoubtedly be one element. Of course, this will not be cheap, but it will be cheap at the price, since what we are buying with such a package is the opening up and enrichment of policy debate with a consequent sharpening of the critical process out of which policies emerge. In an increasingly information-rich society, the ability to analyse that information as it affects one's own interests is a prerequisite for effective involvement in the democratic process. The right to information is of little use by itself. Indeed, bureaucrats can as well hide the facts by swamping, that's that word again, by swamping people in information as by withholding it. There should also be, as a basic human right in an information society, not just a right to information, but a right to analysis. Liberty, fraternity, analytic capability. It has a strange ring to it. But then, no doubt, so did the original battle cry 200 years ago. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jonathan, for that witty and enlightening reminder of what the past decade and more has been about. I was personally somewhat relieved to notice that in that list of problems that you put up in the 1980s, I don't think I worked personally on any of them myself. But I was reminded of an experience which, in a sense, I don't think I've ever quite got over, of going to see the Prime Minister in some alarm and saying to her, "But Prime Minister, the facts are..." And she turned to me in some irritation, I think, and said, "What you have to understand is that I was elected to change the facts." It was at that point that I decided that deep down, where it counts, I was an academic, and it was and it was time that I got back to a university. Well, Jonathan, we are very delighted to see that you are still with us and still in the university. I have to tell you that in our excursion this afternoon into our own local little swamp, we did come across one or two little local problems, which I hope we can look to you to help us with. Charity and much else begins at home. Thank you very much.